Hiya, Tim here with a message before the podcast. Due to rights reasons, the songs have been shortened for this podcast. Every song is taken from Joan Armour Trading's self-titled third album. All tracks are written by Joan Armour Trading. Joan Armour Trading was released in July 1976 on A&M. Now, enjoy the podcast.
Where real music matters.
Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.
Hiya, and welcome to another episode of Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. I'm Tim Burgess, and I'm excited to be sitting down with another musician to play back a classic album together. If you missed any episodes of the show, Nile Rodgers, Snow Patrol, Franz Ferdinand, The Cure, make sure you catch up by searching for Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts. I love hearing from you, so get involved on social media at Tim_Burgess and at Absolute Radio using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party. The episode is a little bit different because I'm not only joined by the artist behind a legendary album, but also the producer behind it too. I'm delighted to be joined by Joan Armour Trading and Glyn Johns to talk about Joan's self-titled third album from 1976. In the 70s, Joan Armour Trading became one of the first British female singer-songwriters to achieve international success thanks to her brilliant musicianship and vivid songwriting. Glyn Johns, meanwhile, boasts a CV to parallel any record producer, having worked with the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, Led Zeppelin, the Kinks, Bob Dylan, the Clash, Eagles, Eric Clapton, and of course, Joan Armour Trading. Thank you very much, both of you, for coming on the listening party. Today we're going to be talking about album number three, simply titled
My Name.
How did you come up with the title?
I was born.
You know, what was happening like leading up to the third album? I mean, obviously you'd made two albums before.
Yeah,
can you set the scene, please?
Well, I made the first album with Gus Dudgeon. Mm-hmm. And I say this all the time, how lucky was I to have worked with Gus Dudgeon first and then with Glyn Johns. I mean, how many people can say they worked with two of the best producers ever? That was great to work with Gus. And then I worked with... And I'm always writing. I've been writing since I was young, for 11, 12, 13, 14. And that's really all I'm interested in. I was interested in it then, I'm interested in it now. So wrote the first album, then obviously went on to write the second album, and then as soon as I've written an album, I'm ready to write the next album.
Okay.
So that's really how that goes. There's nobody saying to me, it's time to write an album, I'm just writing. But when I did the second album, it was with somebody that I wasn't really happy to be doing the second album with. Uh-huh. If it hadn't been for Gus showing me that it was great to be in the studio with somebody really good, after that second album, I probably would have given up. But during it, when I was incredibly unhappy, I knew that this was what I wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
And each producer that I've worked with, it's been the record company that said, do you want to work with this person? So it's never me that's saying,
right,
this is the person, because I don't know anybody, I don't know anything.
And you take suggestions?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know, so I just wait for them to say, this is a good person to work with.
Yeah.
So the record company would have said, Glyn is a good person to work with. And then they steered me towards Glyn.
Towards Glyn. Were you aware of Glyn's work?
Not in a huge way, but yes, I mean, Glyn's worked with The Who, The Beatles, The Stones, so you know the different people. And then it's just a matter of, once they've said, this is the person, and they've introduced you to the person, then it's, do you like the person?
It's chemistry.
That's actually the big thing, and then I have to go back to...
That was the biggest hurdle to
And then I have to go back to, how lucky am I to have had Gus and Glyn?
And Glyn,
you don't get that often.
And Glyn, what were you working on just before you met with Joan?
To be honest, I can't remember. Probably Eric and the Eagles immediately prior... I think I can't. I don't know. I've made a lot of records, so I can't.
Yeah.
I don't know the chronology of everything.
Show
off. Yeah. I could mention a few other very famous people.
Yeah.
That I've worked with before, Joan. I was busy, you know what I mean. Yeah.
Always busy.
Always busy.
And how were you made aware of Joan? Had you known the two albums before?
Or? The guy that ran A&M in England was a guy called Derek Green, who had become a good friend, and he suggested I work with Joan. Yeah. And A&M sent me to Washington, D.C. to see Joan play.
Oh, fantastic.
Not really, no.
Were you in London at the time?
I was in London, yeah. So, and actually, I didn't... It's quite difficult. If you go and see an artist play, obviously there are a lot of contributory factors as to how well you can actually get the right idea of what's going on. Yeah. And the place that I saw Joan play was a very small club. She had quite a big band on a very small stage. The sound system wasn't very good. And to be honest, I wasn't that impressed.
Yeah, I thought I was rubbish.
Oh, no, I didn't think you were rubbish. I just didn't understand quite what it was all about. So Derek, I've rang Derek when I got back to him. I said, I don't think this is for me. And he said, I think you're wrong and you should check it out more. And I said, I'd happily do that. Well, why don't Joan and I meet in your office and perhaps she can play me a couple of songs?
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
And it took four bars of the first song and I got what the hell was going on, and I was in with both feet. Just remarkable.
Yeah.
Blew me away. Nothing like I'd ever worked with before musically. So it was a huge challenge, and obviously a learning process, which is what we all look for in our life, I think. It was great.
Okay, let's kick off this listening party with the first track from the album. It's Down to Zero.
Down to the ground, down to the ground.
So the first track is Down to Zero, a single, the opener. It's got some beautiful, purposeful piano and BJ Cole on pedal steel.
BJ, yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, for us it's the opener, but was it always intended to be the opener? Was it always intended to be a single?
I don't know if it was always intended to be a single. Whatever song I write, I think this could be great.
Be good.
This is it. That's two of us. And so whenever I write, I think, oh, yeah, that's going to be... I mean, some things you know obviously would not make a single, but
right.
Other things you think, yeah, that's going to be a single. But I don't write like that. I don't write thinking, this is a single. I write the song to be the song. And it comes from something. It's usually a reason for writing it.
Yeah.
So the reason for writing that one was that I had two friends. They were both breaking up from their boyfriends at the same time.
Yeah.
And they both kind of said the same sort of thing, like, how dare you break up with me because I'm so beautiful. And it was quite incredible to see how similar they were. So that's how Down to Zero came about. And then when I'm writing, I'm not thinking this is the rhythm I want. I'm actually just playing the rhythm that my body tells me to play.
Yes,
I'm
funny
not
that,
working
yeah.
out this needs to be 4/4, 6/8. I'm not. None of that comes into my head. I'm just thinking this is how I need it to be, and I just do that. It's because I don't know what I'm doing that half the time it comes out. But you know, they do say, and I say, that a lot of what you write is just a load of mistakes. And you have to know that that mistake is what you should keep.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. Glenn, what do you remember?
You asked about running order and the opener and all this.
Yeah.
When I make an album with anybody, the running order is never considered until everything's finished. And then you sit down and you try and work out and you try things and see.
Yeah.
And Down to Zero was obviously the obvious opener, really. Yeah. It sort of sets the thing up really well. Yeah. Great song. But one of the things that fascinated me about the whole project of working with Joan is that I'd never worked with anybody who played guitar like she does. It's just completely original. It's almost like jazz. It's unpredictable.
It is unpredictable.
Yeah,
again,
but that's why it's so wonderful. Yeah.
My father played the guitar and he didn't want me to touch his guitar. And the only song I've ever heard him play on the guitar is a song called Blue Moon, and he played it in a very jazzy way. So I think that's where the jazzy things comes from for me. But he would literally hide that guitar, and it made me want to... he absolutely hid it. And in fact, when we moved house, he forgot it where he'd hidden it, so it didn't come with us.
Serves him right.
Yeah, absolutely. But the only thing he taught me on the guitar was how to tune it, which is obviously the most important part of learning to play the guitar. So, the jazzy thing, I think, comes from him. But when I started to play the guitar, it wasn't from books. Mm-hmm. I just made up what I... Obviously, later on, I got books to know what the chords were. But it wasn't from books. It was just kind of working out the sounds and the rhythms that I wanted to hear. And so that's why it was kind of unpredictable and a little bit undisciplined.
Yeah.
But as Green says, that's a good thing.
I don't think it's
undisciplined.
I don't think it's undisciplined at all. Yeah. Quite the reverse, actually. It's just brilliant.
Thank you.
There you go. It's all right.
Yeah. I wasn't thinking about what was that. I just thought that's how it needs to be. So I just did that, which is kind of what I still do. I still just play how I feel it needs to be rather than thinking about how it should be.
Yeah, I understand that.
But Down to Zero, like Glenn, I don't remember any specifics about it, but I do remember for the whole album, we had a great time making the album, and by the time we'd finished the album, I think we all thought we'd made a great album.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we had... really nice moments, all the parts, there were just really nice moments of just listening to good music and good musicians and great atmosphere. Again, I've got to say it, when you have a great atmosphere in the studio, because that's very, very important that you get the right atmosphere. Everybody feels involved, everybody feels that they're a part of what's happening. And just a reference back to that second album, that's not what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that second album, with all its faults, taught me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have something that makes you feel uncomfortable and everybody else is kind of almost looking over their shoulders as, is this what's supposed to happen? That's not good. But when you have two people who would say everybody's in it, you know, as we all want, all want to be in it, we're all part of it. Then it works out. You have a great atmosphere, and that lifts the music.
Let's hear another song. This is the second from the album. It's Help Yourself.
Help yourself. Help yourself. You want to get yourself together? Don't you want to put yourself to right? I said, get yourself together. Don't you want to put yourself to right? I said,
Joan, tell me about that last track.
That's got some great guitar stuff in there, and Help Yourself.
Everything's got great guitar.
It's got an incredible sort of shift of tempo, like a musical gear change. That was what I wrote in my notes.
I couldn't play that song now.
I should have made it.
And wonderful electric piano flourishes and chord changes too.
Yeah.
Which
is me, yeah.
Was it a Wurlitzer or Fender Rhodes, maybe?
It could have been either, I can't remember.
Mm.
I'd have to hear it to see.
Yeah.
I can't remember. I haven't listened to this record since I made it.
Because he's so. So
well, that's it. I mean, people move on, don't they?
Yeah.
Exactly. It's not because I don't like the record.
Oh, no, of course not.
It's just that I've moved on to...
I haven't played it either, but because I'm playing the song...
Live on the stage.
Live on stage.
Yeah.
Sounds kind of California-inspired, I thought.
You hear me say I'm just doing my own thing,
mm-hmm.
So I'm not looking to see, well, this is the fad or this is the thing to be inspired by,
mm-hmm.
or this is what is popular.
Yeah.
Again, I'm aware of music. I'm aware of the different things.
Yeah.
But I'm not
influenced.
I'm not influenced. I'm not trying to do that.
Well, if
thing.
You listen to the record, it's abundantly clear that you're not.
Yeah, so that's the thing. I was listening to some, I won't say who they are, but I was listening to somebody today on the radio.
Yeah.
And every time I hear a song of theirs, I can tell who they've been listening to.
Right.
They've
either
been
right.
listening to The Killers or U2 or somebody. You can hear it. Every single record is that person.
Yeah.
And they even take bits of their not only the sonically the thing, but mm-hmm. the musically they're yeah. like taking bits of it.
Yeah,
I personally don't think that's good.
No,
I think you can admire somebody and you can think they're great, which is what I do. There's so many yeah. people I think are yeah. absolutely brilliant, and I admire them, and I think. Yeah. How clever are you?
Yeah.
You know, that you could come up with that.
Yeah.
But I don't want to take your thing from you. That's your thing.
Yeah.
I need to come up with
I'm sure
my
that
thing
a lot
is.
Of the instances that you're referring to are subliminal. They're not deliberate. They're just...
Yeah, they're...
Yeah. Everybody is affected by everything they're listening
absolutely.
To in some way.
Yeah.
And you take it in and you... All of a sudden... I mean, I've been with people who... And somebody's pointed out that the bridge is a bit like something or other, and yeah. the artist hasn't got a clue. You know, they've just been influenced by something.
Yeah,
by
but you try. I try. I'm sure somebody will say, "Oh, if I hear this bit, it sounds like whatever." But I try consciously when I've
Absolutely.
Written whatever
Absolutely.
To listen to it to say, "Does that sound like anything?
No,
is
no.
that mine?"
Yeah, you are an exception so, to that without any question. Yeah.
I think that's what you're supposed
yeah.
to do, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. do you kind of like not listen purposely to other people when you're writing? I know people who do that, you know.
Yeah,
they just don't listen to anything while they're writing because they're scared of being influenced by something, you know, because people do pick up on stuff.
Yeah. You know? No, I don't listen to if I'm writing. I'm
yeah.
not listening to something else.
That's good.
But I do listen to other things
yeah.
and on the radio.
Yes.
I haven't got a big record collection. I don't play lots of records. I haven't got lots of records. I listen to the radio because I like to know what's happening now, because
right,
we
yeah.
are now,
yeah.
aren't we? We're
well, we are now,
2025
yeah.
and not
yeah.
1976,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
so we need to know what's happening.
Yeah.
I don't think I do.
Lyric. There's a lyric here. If you're going to say it, say now. Don't leave,
yeah,
it,
leave
overnight.
It overnight.
Yeah,
yeah,
I really like that.
Yeah, because quite often, I mean, I think sometimes I repeat myself. There's a song called Shapes and Sizes, and it's really saying the same thing. Don't wait until somebody's not around to say how much you love them or
well, yeah, yeah,
how
yeah.
great they were or,
yeah,
you know,
big.
It might be a nice idea to tell them now
mm-hmm.
while they're around to hear it. Or if there's something you want to do, it's a good idea to have a go at it.
Yeah.
It's all right if you don't make it. It's all right if it's not a success.
Yeah.
I think the biggest not a success is if you don't even try to do it. So if there's anything that I feel I want to do, I'll always have a go at it.
Do you succeed most of the time?
Yeah.
I thought so.
In her eyes.
You got to govern the situation.
That's it.
Yeah,
you
got
go.
To govern the situation.
You got that lyric.
Yeah.
So, but did you hear what Glenn said? In my eyes.
Hey, that's the only positive way to be.
Well,
you wouldn't be doing it
absolutely.
Otherwise. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, you first of all have to like what you're doing yourself.
Yes.
Before somebody else tells
yeah,
you this is
yeah.
great. That's.
Yeah.
I hear people say very often, oh, they don't know how good they are when they play, or they don't know how good they are when they sing. I'm thinking, well, how did they get to be good then if they don't know? I mean, how do you get to be good if you don't know you're being good?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't make much sense to me. So you've got to know aspects of your talent
yeah.
to be able to make it work.
And to improve
mm.
as well. You know, if you base stuff on, you know, previous work, trying to better that, yeah, a good
yeah.
thing to do.
Yeah, you just want to just write stuff and always finish it. Whatever
right.
whatever I start, I finish.
Yeah.
I might not keep it, but I'll finish it.
Yeah.
Because I'm scared that if I don't finish it, I won't be able to finish the next one.
With an album, do you think, you know, so there's 10 tracks on this one, would you write maybe 12 or something and then pick the best 10 out of the 12?
I can't
remember or do you just
how
pretend?
We did for
we
this
probably
one.
Did. We did more than 10, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But I mean, it depends on how much material the artist has got. But I wouldn't think about making a record without recording at least 12.
Yeah.
You know, maybe 14.
Yeah.
Because not everything works out.
Yeah.
So it gives you an option.
Yeah.
And also to balance it musically as far as tempo and just the flow of the
yeah.
whole album. In those days, we made albums, which was meant to be listened to from the beginning to the end. Of course, that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
So it's a completely different way of going about it.
So I would definitely have written more then.
Yeah.
I could have written even up to 20 songs.
Yeah.
More even. But I would have only presented the ones that I felt was good. So
felt Glyn, right for the project.
Yeah, so Glyn might not have heard 20 songs.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we'd choose from whatever we'd done. So in those days, that's what I would do. I'd write loads of songs. Mm-hmm. These days, for the past 20 or whatever years, and certainly for the last 10 or the last 4 or 5 albums, I just write what you hear.
Okay.
And quite often, I'll write in the running order.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
So, and sometimes it's literally the first song that you hear is the first song I wrote in
that
way.
That's incredible, yeah.
Sometimes that's how it goes. Not always, but sometimes that's how it goes. And so if there's 12 songs on the album, I've only written 12these days. Because I feel as if I can edit well enough to do that. Again, it's subjective. Somebody else might say, Joan, you should have written 20 for that one and then chosen, you know. It's subjective, but in my eyes, as Glyn says, I think that's fine. I'm quite happy with doing that. But the Joan and Michele album, that was 76. Then we did the Show Some Emotion, was it?
I don't remember what order it
was. 70, 77. Then we did To the Limit, 78. Yeah. So it was like, you know, an album with all those songs year after year.
Yeah.
And that's what people did.
Absolutely. You were expected to make an album, tour it,
and find
time to write.
And you did that.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't feel any pressure because I just loved writing, so I was always writing.
Yeah.
I remember one time being asked out by the record company to come on a boat trip. I said, I can't come on a boat trip, I'm writing.
did you write on tour as well?
No.
Different headspace.
The only song I've ever written on tour is a song called Call Me Names.
Right.
And that I wrote because two guys in the band were always having a go at each other. And one was tall and one was little. And that's why it's kind of Big Woman and a Short Man. And that's what made me write that, because of how they were.
Fantastic. Time for another song. Here's track number 3. It's Water with the Wine.
Drank some whiskey, hung his gold upon the stand. That's when the music started. I heard the lights switch. I stumbled on a lost shoe. Fever started. This man was getting high. I got no strength to make him stop. I guess it's too late, but I'll know next time to mix some water with the wine.
Tell me about that last song.
Yeah, now that's like a fun sort of song, isn't it? That song, I'll tell you how it was written. I was on the train one day and this chap came up to me to chat me up and he actually followed me home.
Right.
And he was obviously trying to get me to go out with him and he followed me home and he was talking about, you know, let's go for a drink, let's do this. Well, I don't drink alcohol. But somebody that I know, they would put water in their wine. And they said to me, Joan, because you don't drink, this is a great way of trying alcohol, which I never did. Mm-hmm. They said, you just put the water in the wine and then you're away. So with that guy following me and trying to get me to go out and then think of the water with the wine, that they got together. So that's how that song got written.
There's a line, I guess it's too late, but I'll know next time.
Yeah.
And that's about that, right?
Yes, about that. Guess it's too late, but I know next time to mix the water with the wine. And I have to say, that guy followed me. I don't know where he lived or where he was going,
right.
But that was from London to Hayes.
How far is that?
Not that far, really, but that was out of his way, really.
Yeah.
He obviously liked you.
Yep.
Some nice organ on this song.
That's got to be Pete again, then.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's the only keyboard player.
I'm in a band with a Hammond organ player.
Are you?
How do you mic up your Hammond organs?
Mind your own. Liberty.
Do
Do you really want to know?
Oh, yeah, yeah, I do, I do.
I'll show you later. It won't be very good for a radio program.
But two at the top, one at the bottom? Or?
One at the bottom, two at the top. But if you put the... This is so...
No, lovely. It's fantastic. Okay. This is what I want.
Okay. Okay. A Leslie speaker has two trumpet speakers on the top end. And it revolves. Uh-huh. If you mic it either side, you're going to hear the same. You don't get any movement if you spread it in the stereo.
Okay.
Because you're hearing the same thing out of each side, aren't you? Because the two speakers are... So you put one here and one in front and one to the side. And then you get the movement of the sound from...
Yeah. And the bottom is just
saying the old mic, doesn't make any difference.
And is the bottom kind of more bassy? Or?
Oh, it's much more bassy.
Much more bassy,
It's the low end of the instrument.
Got you. Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. I think that's great.
That'll be 10 guineas.
I think people will be very excited about that. And so you recorded one of my favourite records, Ogden's Nut Gone Flake, by The Small Faces.
Yes.
And Kenny Jones is playing on this record as well.
Bless his heart.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Brilliant. I knew him since he was 16, I think. Just incredible drummer.
Oh yeah.
Incredible drummer. It's him on It's Only Rock and Roll by the Rolling Stones, by the way. That's not Charlie.
No,
that's Kenny.
Charlie,
no. They cut a demo in someone's basement.
As the Faces. It was meant to be for the Faces,
No. Kenny was visiting one of the Stones.
Yeah.
Someone in Richmond.
And, exactly. And they came up with, so Charlie wasn't there and Kenny was, so Kenny played. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
He's very, understated. He's not understated. He himself is understated, but his playing is spot on. Yeah, so you look at him and he's very cool when he's playing. You might, if you just look at him, think not a lot's going on.
Right.
But if you listen, it's all happening. It's very, totally in the pocket, totally in the groove, really knows what...
Doesn't show off. Nothing clever. No, brilliant.
The drums just do what they're supposed to do. All the fills happen in the right places. Anything that's a little bit behind the beat is in the right place where it needs to be. And his timing is fantastic, isn't it? His timing is just impeccable. Yeah.
Wow. It's important for a singer, that the drummer's always in the pocket. The little gaps where your voice is.
And not fussy.
No.
Not fussy at all.
He doesn't show off, basically.
No. I mean, Dave Mattox is... he's a great drummer as well, but he's a more fussy drummer, isn't he?
Well, he's technically qualified to do anything.
Yeah.
Play any time signature. You could make one up and he'd play it immediately. Yeah. Very bright, meticulous.
Yeah.
To the nth degrees. Drum kit looks like it's just come out the drum shop.
Right.
Just everything about him. But... particularly useful on this record that we're talking about.
Yeah.
He was required and did the brilliant job.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah.
I couldn't say any one of those musicians was better than the other, really, because they were all just on their game, really, weren't they?
Absolutely.
They were all totally on it.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Well, they were all blown away by being in the room with you without any question. No, because
the songs,
I'm serious.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like I'm blowing smoke up your WhatsApp, but I'm not. The fact of the matter is that none of us had heard anything like what she was doing before. Yeah. And it just was like being taken down a new road, musically.
Yeah.
So for them in particular, who were very busy guys, they were working with everybody and their mother, it was brilliant, because they were getting the opportunity to stretch out and do stuff that they'd never contemplated doing.
And I guess you responded, by stuff like doing, amplifying your thing, to a new degree.
I'd like to think so. I got very excited.
Yes,
I do know that.
Fantastic.
I found the whole thing very exciting. As I say, the atmosphere was great. The sounds were great. Everybody was treated well. Somebody bringing in a tea was treated well, patience of it, because some things obviously would take a little bit longer than others, but the patience was there from everybody to go through it,
because some of it was quite complex and was a bit of a challenge, so it needed a bit
but
they were all very happy to make sure it was right.
Next up is Love and Affection, and before we talk about it, let's hear it.
Just take my hand and station, don't wait goodnight.
Well, give me love.
Don't just make love with affection. Sing me another love song, but this time with a little dedication. Sing it, sing it, sing it, sing it. You know that's what I like.
Give me love.
Once more with the feeling. Give me love, give me love, give me love.
Joan, please tell me about the brilliant song we just heard.
Affection. That's
okay, yes.
Boring.
So you do Top of the Pops. I remember this on Top of the Pops.
Yeah. So that was a song that when I wrote it, I definitely thought that should be a single.
Right.
And that's the song I said to the record company, I wanted it to be the single, and they said, remember, Joan, you asked for it. I don't know. It's like you write certain things and you know that thing is really good. But you're supposed to, aren't you? It's like,
yes.
It's like I always quote Mark Knopfler's song of Money for Nothing.
Yeah.
You know, he knew that that was really good. And he heard the guys talking about, look at that person on MTV, that's money for nothing. So he said what they said in the shop.
Yeah.
So you've got to know.
Yeah.
And I can actually take you to the store that I was standing outside in the King's Road, where I came up with Love and Affection. It's a very important song. To me.
Did you know it was going to be an absolute classic?
Did I know it would be a classic? No. You don't know.
You just
stuff
felt
like
good
that.
About it, though.
Yeah. I felt absolutely great about it. But it's next year it'll be 50 years.
Wow.
Who knew that that would be 50 years later? People would be still in love with that song.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know that. Would you, Glenn? I wouldn't have known that.
Of course not.
No, you don't know.
Of course you don't.
And actually, you don't even hope. You're not even thinking along those lines. It's only when things happen that you think along those lines. You know, if you go back to the early days when the Stones and the Beatles and everything, there's no way the Beatles thought they would become the biggest group in the world.
Of course
not. So influential, have a history that they've got, that would be talked about in 200 years' time. They didn't know that, and they didn't think that. If they tell you they did, they're lying, because you don't. But once people start to tell you, that, like Glenn says what he says, and people say to me, you've had an influence on certain things, or you've trailblazed, or stuff like that, I'm not thinking stuff like that. I'm just doing the stuff that I'm doing. It's only because people tell me some of these things that I might think about it. But
yeah.
I don't think about it. I'm just aware of it now.
Of course.
You know,
yeah,
but, yeah. And you can't think like that. You can't think, I'm a trailblazer. What do you know? How do you know you're a trailblazer?
No.
You've got to do something and then and people have got to acknowledge it and kind of buy into it, and it's got to last and all that kind of stuff. You can't just say, I'm a trailblazer. It doesn't really work like that.
Well, the song certainly lasted. Did did you pay any special attention to this particular song, Glenn?
I don't think I paid any more attention to it than any of the others. They were all great.
Of course.
I mean, obviously, it was fairly obvious. It was pretty fab. But obviously now, of course, I knew.
Of course.
It's all me. I was my arrangement. And,
am I right in thinking that it's been sampled a few times as well?
Yeah, it has. So Richard Ashcroft has done a version of Love and Affection.
Oh, fantastic.
So he's just done a, you know, like he did
Sweet Symphony.
Yeah, so it's kind of like that. So he's taken, and you hear me in it.
Oh, great.
But you only hear me going, love, ooh-hoo, and I think sing it. I think it sounds great.
Yeah, fantastic. Oh, well, congratulations.
Yeah, he's done a great job.
The next song, and this is going to be the end of side one, Save Me is the name of the song.
Oh, bloody brilliant. I think I got an award for that.
For this song?
No, yeah, for the song. I didn't write it, but I got
it. the recording of it.
For an NME Marvellous, You're Marvellous award. I can't remember. But fantastic. Yeah. Absolutely fantastic. Beautiful.
Great organ sound.
Probably.
Yes. And drums, you know, big. Rocking.
And lovely guitar sounds as well.
Yeah.
Just lovely sound. The whole atmosphere of that. It's capturing that atmosphere. It's up to me, but it's up to the producer as well, as I said, to capture that essence of the song, to get all the sounds that's supposed to make you go, ah.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Got to get all of that right, and got to get all the balance of it once you start. And again, that's Glenn.
Yes, really lovely orchestrated with the, you know, just natural just sounds.
Getting all of that right.
Yeah.
So,
well, if you're given the ingredients that we were, it's a piece of cake from my point of view.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
No, it's
absolutely brilliant.
Fantastic. That's a very popular song as well.
I should think it is. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very popular. It always goes down well when I sing it on stage. I like it.
Yeah, I like it too. Okay, let's hear Save Me. Some of your touches, you know, and sounds, I think, and the sound of Olympic Studios as well,
and
some great brass moments and some wonderful strings and
piano
flourishes, you know, some hi-hat. I would love to talk about Kenny Jones, but it sounds like a kind of hi-hat recordings that you did on Ogden's Not Gone Flake.
Dave Mattox played on most of the record.
Right.
Kenny played on one thing or two things. There are some amazing musicians. The biggest problem about working with Joan has always been selecting musicians that can keep up, basically, and contribute in a way that will please her and do her material justice, because it's nothing like they've ever played before, I can tell you now.
Right.
And I was really lucky to have recently been working with everybody that we booked on that record. I mean, you got a couple of singers but I got booked everyone else. And particularly Dave Marquis, the bass player on that record, is just remarkable.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They were all great. Jerry Donahue, the guitar player.
All great.
It was fantastic. It was a really wonderful experience. Really wonderful. Kept me on my toes, I can tell you. Yeah.
And you talked about sound. That's Glenn. I mean, even though I would do my demos myself and engineer it and do everything myself, when it came to the studio, that was Glenn's domain to be in charge of getting that sound that everybody knew and loved. And as he says, all the musicians would be Glenn, apart from the guy who's singing the bass voice on Love and Affection and a couple of other singers. Yeah. I got in. But again, I don't really know people. So every producer that I work with, I rely on them to introduce me to the musicians.
Are you happy that you don't really know people,
Joan?
You just kind of keep yourself to yourself.
Because otherwise I'd probably be using the same people all the time.
That's a good point.
I don't think that's particularly healthy myself. And producers, because they're working with different people all the time.
There's always someone coming through.
They've got lots of different people that they can reference. So I'm really happy for that.
Wonderful.
And, you know, again, I have to reference Gus and Glenn because they but the two absolute best people. And they always seem to know fantastic musicians. You know, really, really strong musical talents.
Wonderful stuff. So did you set everybody up and, you know, record live? Or
Absolutely.
Totally
live vocal.
Yeah.
Most, not all the vocals.
Yeah.
The live vocals were kept, but most, a lot of them were. And that's essential, particularly for the sort of material that Joan was writing, with those guys, because obviously everyone was getting off by what they were hearing from Joan and then from each other, because it was nothing like they'd ever been allowed to do before. And a lot of the guys knew each other already. I mean, they played with each other, but that's also... I mean, obviously, when you're putting a rhythm section together, it's important not only that they understand and appreciate the artist, but that they all get on well, there is a bit of camaraderie in the room to begin with. I mean, the atmosphere of the producer is responsible for, in fact, is incredibly important as far as making a record, to get the best out of the artist, never mind about anything. Obviously, the artist has got to feel really comfortable and excited you know.
And did everyone show up at the right time? And
oh, yeah. If anybody didn't show up at the right time, they wouldn't be booked.
That's a good discipline. I like that.
Yeah.
But it's that thing that I was saying. It's making everybody feel as if they are a part of it. They're not just session guys, you know. Yeah. Everybody feels that the contribution that they're making is important to what's happening.
Fantastic.
And that's the beauty of, I'm sorry I keep referencing Gus, but I've got two great references here.
And
both work the same way. Gus was the same, Vin is the same. They make everybody feel as if they're part of it. You're there to support me, but you're part of it.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Next up is Join the Boys.
Oh, Join the Boys. Yeah, I love the guitar playing in this, excuse me. It's got great acoustic guitar playing in this. It's really kind of one of my showing off guitar playing pieces.
It's very impressive, I've got to say.
And that was written, I had a band, again, I don't think I've ever said this, but I had a band called The Movies, who were my backup band. Do you know that band?
Mm.
And they were kind of going through a thing, and one of them was a little bit of an outsider, and it felt like it should be, you know, don't be an outsider, come and join in what we're doing. So that was written really with what I was watching happening with them. So they were my backing band. They were a band in their own right. And then again, it was the record company who said, might be an idea if you used them as your backing band. And so that would be 1975. And I supported Supertramp and took them on the road. So that was great.
Was that in the UK?
That was just in the UK.
Yeah.
And then it was witnessing the dynamics in the band that made me write that.
So an observer.
I mean, my songs are generally from observation.
Yeah.
They're generally looking to see what's happening around me, how people are treating each other, what they're saying to each other.
Yeah.
Show some emotion, which isn't on this album, but I wrote that because I was in a place and I saw a group of men all talking to each other. But the one guy, even though he was laughing with everybody and as if he was a part of it, I could see by his eyes that he wasn't a part of it. He wasn't smiling. His eyes didn't smile.
Right.
So that's what made me write Show Some Emotion, Light Up If You're Feeling Happy, if it's bad.
I wish you hadn't told me that.
Oh, sorry. Sorry about that. What did you think it was about?
Well, I can't remember, but it certainly wasn't about some blokes not being realistic with his eyes in the conversation. You assume, particularly if something's sung in the first person,
but
that it's about an experience of yours. It's usually a relationship of some sort, or you know.
Yeah. But that's how I write. I write in the first person, but it's not generally me.
Yeah.
Me, myself, I, yes.
Yeah.
But in general, it's not me, because there's too many songs for it to be me, you know?
No, I get it.
23 albums. Yeah. You don't want to be hearing Joan all the time.
No.
It's too much. And people would say Joni Mitchell, all the songs are about her. They're not all
her.
You just don't want to do that. That's too weird.
But you put yourself in the position as the narrator.
And as I say, the songs are generally from something that I'm looking at, or somebody's told me, or I've read.
Yeah.
Might have even seen on the television. And then I write it as if it's... Because that's the way I write. It's the way I write best.
Wonderful. Mm. All right, let's hear the first track from side two, Join the Boys.
Succeed where others fail, and stay together many years, and watch us take the world by storm. Are you in? Are you out? Do you care to dance about and shout? Don't judge on the boys being abandoned a one night stand.
So, Glenn, when you hear a song, do you refer to the demo? Like, you're in the studio, you know, you got all the musicians around and Joan's waiting to sing. Do you refer to the demo, or do you...
They'd have heard the demo.
The musicians, I presume, would have heard the demo, but then do you go...
not necessarily, no. Well, I might get Joan to play the song to them. That would be the way to do it.
Yeah.
But I don't remember particularly having demos of anything, but I'm sure I did. I don't know. You and I would sit and you'd play me things.
Yeah.
I know that much. But no, in the studio, I would tend to get Joan to play to the assembled musicians.
Yeah, because and I guess then, everyone feels more involved then, don't they, rather than just playing like this.
You don't need to play a demo if she's there, you know.
That's a good point.
It's much easier. And equally, interestingly, the less... If you record a demo and you've overdubbed drums or whatever else it is, the less they hear, the more likely they're able to interpret what the song is and how it started, which was on a guitar with her voice. So they're not influenced by anything else, and they're automatically, everybody, including me, is coming up with ideas in your mind about what you think should complement the mood and the sound of the thing.
And obviously I would say...
Yeah, there'd be an input from Joan. Yeah, of course it would, And I'd say you were wrong, and they'd say
But you would have heard the demos, though, Glyn.
Probably.
Yeah, you would have heard the demos.
Yes. Yeah. I can't remember. Yeah. I've made 9,000 albums. I'm amazed I found my way here. She was obviously quite concerned about it. She sent me 94 texts telling me what time I should be here.
How many performances are there of Join the Boys on 2-inch?
I wouldn't have a clue.
I don't remember us doing like stacks and stacks and stacks and stacks of takes, do you?
No, not on anything.
No.
How many takes would we probably do?
We would have gone through before starting to take, but we would have had some...
Like three or four or something.
Run throughs.
Yeah. Run it through, get to a point where it's... fairly together. Take it.
Yeah.
Have everybody come in.
Yeah,
and listen to what they're up to. Yeah. Comments from Joan, which would be ignored. And everybody would talk about what they were up to.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we'd go out and do it. And, you know, Miss Marvellous over here. Every take from her was bloody wonderful. And of course, everyone else failed. But it was pretty, it was really smooth. Good musicians, that really.
Yeah, great musicians.
That's the trick.
Oh, yeah, great people. Yeah, and great chemistry, good combination of people.
Yeah.
We did it in Olympic.
We did.
And that was that had a really good atmosphere in itself, didn't it, the studio? It felt like it to
absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely.
Was there a particular studio? Is it just one studio in Olympic?
There were two studios and a mix room.
Yeah.
And this record was done on 8-track, by the way.
Eight track.
Rather than anything.
It wasn't 2-inch then?
No.
Ah.
8-track's only one.
Wow.
So I thought I'd correct you there.
No, well, I mean, to be corrected on air. It's just perfect. That's what people want to hear.
And what I remember about making the record in the Olympic was that everybody was put in their sections.
Yeah.
You know, so I'd be there with the thing from singing, the drums would be over here or the back, wherever it was. Can't remember if you put screens round.
The rhythm section was set up in a line facing the control room, as if they would be on stage, but with screens separating each. The drums would have high screens behind, but so that everybody had a view of it, they could see each other, they could talk to each other without using a microphone. And they, more than importantly, hopefully they could see you.
Yeah. I seem to always remember the keyboards off to the side rather than... off to the side. Yeah. So it was almost like doing a gig.
Right.
Well, that's the idea of the setup, so it's familiar to everybody.
Yeah.
Really.
So you're just playing and just hearing, just really enjoying what you're hearing.
Yeah.
It was really nice.
Is this the same room as the very famous footage of the Rolling Stones doing Sympathy for the Devil?
Yeah,
so it's that room. So it looks like it's like, you know, really light.
Same setup, that was my session as well.
You've done some sessions. You have done some sessions.
Oh, this is true.
He's done 96,000, didn't you say? Was it 98,000?
98,000, yeah. 98,000.
99, I don't know. Can't remember. Anyway, same room.
Same room.
Great room.
It's gorgeous.
Great room. They spent £4 doing the acoustic treatment on it. Sort of almost egg boxes on the wall. It's not, but it's really no money was spent, and it's just the best sounding room, the most versatile room. Yeah. You could do a 40-piece orchestra in there.
Yeah.
You could do absolutely anything. Jazz, Hendrix recorded in there. Yeah. I did all the Stone stuff in there. And it would all sound marvellous. It's just great room. Great equipment.
Yeah.
Too.
Of course, it's not a studio anymore.
It's a cinema.
It's gone back to being...
Cinema.
It was a cinema before,
right.
Originally.
So it's gone back to being a cinema.
Yeah.
posh cinema.
Very posh, yeah.
Time for another song. This is Joan Armatrading with People on Tim's Listening Party. People from Joan Armatrading's third album. Joan Armatrading and producer Glyn Johns are still with me. Joan, what can you tell me about that last song?
People. Again, that's got, excuse me saying, it's got some really nice acoustic guitar playing on that. It's got a really kind of funky rhythm to it.
So soulful.
Yeah.
I would say kind of Staxy.
Yeah.
But only funky. In... a feeling.
Yeah. People, that's a little bit me, myself, I type.
Right, okay. You know,
I love people, obviously, but sometimes you don't need to be around people.
Yes, yeah.
That's really quite me. It says people to the left of me, people to the right, I want to be alone.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's, sometimes it's just too much.
People all around me in love and pain.
Yeah.
Yeah, good observation again.
Yeah, it's, I mean, sometimes I'll come into town just to be amongst a crowd.
Yeah.
Because it's quite a nice feeling to have a lot of people around you. But sometimes it's too much. Like when I'm on tour, I tend, apart from when I'm on stage, and I like to be on my own.
There's a great key change at exactly 1:25.
Oh, yeah.
Is that kind of a record for a key change happening?
Well, I don't. That's just what I did.
Absolutely no idea.
That's just what I did.
That's fantastic. It's got a very empathetic and very complex kind of, like, I don't know, it just feels very deep, this one, to me.
I suppose you could say that, only because, as I say, it's great to be amongst people, but sometimes the demands of people on each other can be quite stifling, can be too much.
Overwhelming.
Yeah. And you sometimes need the space just to be on your own, just to kind of breathe, you know, not have to worry about what somebody else is thinking, what their reaction is going to be to what you're doing. Sometimes you just don't need that. You just need to be totally selfish and just be on your own.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that. It's a healthy thing to like your own company, I think.
I think so too. But it's great also to share, you know, making music with other wonderful people too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if we were talking about
musicians,
the album...
Musicians are different though, aren't they?
Yeah. Talking about the album, I absolutely loved making the record. All the records I made with Glyn, I absolutely loved making. And I loved being on stage with the different bands that I've worked with. Because what I like about the musicians, what I really want them to do when they're on stage is they're going to play Love and Affection. I want them to play Love and Affection, but I don't want them to play it word for word as they would, as it is on the album.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I want to be able to, when I'm playing, I want the bass player to make me turn around and go, oh, that was nice.
Yeah.
That's what I want. I don't want, I've heard that, you know. Yeah. And I want the keyboard player to play something that makes me think, really, are you sure? You know, I want stuff that makes me react. I don't want to hear... Somebody said who was in my band, and they immediately went and worked for somebody. Maybe I shouldn't say who they went to work for. And they said every night they had to play literally note for note the same thing. And if they didn't, they would be fined.
Yeah.
And he said that was so boring. Even though they were paid a fortune, it was so boring because it was like almost stifling. They felt they weren't progressing. Nothing was happening.
Yeah.
And that's not good as a musician. You want to experiment. You know, even if you get it wrong, if you play a wrong note, I'd much rather hear a wrong note than just the same boring thing all the time. And when I'm playing, I play something different or I phrase differently, you know, because... it's alive.
Yeah, of course.
You know, you want some excitement about it.
Do you think if you play the wrong note and then you play it again, the same wrong note, it's actually how it's meant to be?
No. If I play the wrong note, I usually laugh. If I play the wrong note quite often, everybody knows I've played the wrong note.
Let's play the next song from the album. It's called Somebody Who Loves You.
Someone who loves you, somebody loves you. Ooh, 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 ooh. You've got someone who loves you, somebody loves you. Cozy corner, your arms around.
Tell me about that last song, the third from side two, Somebody Who Loves You.
Yeah, that's a really sweet song, actually.
That's my favourite, actually, on the album.
That's a really sweet song.
Amazing. Your vocals sound really amazing on that.
Yeah, it's quite gentle, isn't it? It's got really gentle guitar strumming. It's got to be a 12-string. Yeah, I'm sure it's a 12-string.
Cozy corner, your arms around you.
Yeah.
So tired of one-night stands.
Yeah. That, again, is somebody that I knew who was kind of in that situation.
Yeah.
But had somebody who loved them.
Yeah.
And couldn't quite see it, and yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, the vocal sounds incredible on that, so.
Yeah.
Good work, both of you.
Thank you very much.
What kind of mic would it have been?
Probably an SM7.
Right, SM7.
Yeah.
I don't know them.
You'd recognise
it. A ribbon mic.
Yeah, you'd recognise it if you saw it. It's used a lot in broadcasting, funny enough. Great vocal microphone. Different voices require different microphones.
Do you do tests and stuff like that?
Three or four mics. And equally, depending on the key or the...
Or the volume.
Or the volume that she's singing out or whatever.
This is a real soft one, isn't it? Very intimate.
Yeah. But I remember using an SM7 with Joan on that record in particular.
Yeah.
And a particular limiter that I'd never used before, I don't think, and it worked really. The combination of the two worked great with Joan. Yeah.
Amazing.
I bet your listeners found that really interesting.
Oh, well, they will. You want to see into the engine.
Yeah.
I think. I hope so, anyway. Like Fire.
Oh, yeah. This is one of my favourite songs on the album, actually. And again, I'm sorry to say this again, but the guitar playing on this is just...
Is this you?
Yeah.
It's incredible. And it's like, it's acoustic guitar shredding.
Yes, this is me.
Yeah, and it just like, the recording of it is unbelievable.
Yeah. Again, this is my showing off playing the guitar.
Yeah.
But I'm only just playing what I feel. Just playing how I think it should be. But just really, really enjoying it. Because it's a very... It's like your fingers dancing, you know? It's so good.
Yeah.
Excuse me. But it is so good.
It is so good.
And quite... It's not necessarily an easy thing to play either.
Very impressive.
That's a six string.
And there's some slide guitar as well.
Is
it pedal steel, is it?
Bryn Haworth.
Okay, slide. Sometimes it's hard to tell. You know, there was a moment where it was slide, and then I wondered whether it had gone into pedal steel after that, but maybe it was just all slides.
No, he didn't. Yeah. Bryn was a slide guitar.
Yeah, wonderful.
Probably still is.
I hope he still is. I just remember really, really enjoying playing that. It's just a lot of fun.
Is this something that you still enjoy playing live now?
I haven't played it live in forever.
Long time.
And they don't, obviously all the songs don't get aired.
Of course, because it's got so many
live
records.
And they get changed. I think the only song, literally the only song that's been played on every single tour without fail is Love and Affection.
Yeah, of course.
But all the others at some point won't get played. You know, whether it's Drop the Pilot, Me, Myself, I, whichever one, all of them will not have been played at some point on a tour. But Love and Affection, you couldn't get away with it.
Well, that's what they've all come to hear.
Absolutely, yeah. And I'm happy to do it. I love Love and Affection has had so many versions of it. I've done it with just congas, bass and guitar. It's had seven piece, it's had four piece, three piece, all kinds of different versions of it. And again, that's just to keep myself interested, you know, because I've been doing it for however long. You need some change.
It also shows the song in a different light as well.
Yeah.
I think that's great to be able to show the song off.
Yeah. So did it just a couple of weeks back, and that was with everything, bass, drums, guitar, keyboards, sax. And then I did it just a couple of months back, and then I just did a couple of weeks back with everything except drums.
Right, amazing.
And that sounds really good as
I bet.
It sounds really good.
You're listening to Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio, and it's time for the fourth track on side two, the album It's Like Fire. Song is Tall in the Saddle, which is another single.
Was that a single?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I didn't know that. Great song though.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, it's incredible singing, very kind of gospel-y. Say what you will, you can't take the stars at night.
Yeah, that was written kind of round about the same time as Love and Affection. I mean, they were all written in the same kind of thing, but I remember writing those two, and I would have been in haze when I wrote it. And I remember sitting on the floor watching John Wayne film.
Yeah.
And the film, I think, is actually called Tall in the Saddle. And he was in the saddle, John Wayne, and he got off, dismounted. And I thought, oh, you don't look that tall.
Must have been a big horse.
Yeah, big horse. And that's why it says one of these days you're going to have to dismount.
Yeah.
Because he got off the horse, I thought. So that's where Tall in the Saddle came from, watching the John Wayne film.
Amazing.
And sometimes I think, don't tell people what made the song happen, because it takes away, just like it did for you, it takes away the thing. So I sometimes don't want to, but sometimes I think that's actually quite interesting. When I hear other people say why they think, I think, oh, that's
I think it's good with distance as well. From actually, I mean, if you sometimes you don't want to reveal too much when the song's actually out in the present. But you know, when you can look at stuff and talk about it in the past, I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, and I had to get some stuff ready for something, so I was looking at old lyrics that I'd written, and it's really interesting to see what I thought I was going to say that I've crossed out and said what it ended up with. It's really interesting to see that thing. And sometimes some of the things that I've seen, the thing that I'm saying is almost like a, like you're saying it to somebody, like a proper conversation.
Yeah,
but it's too much. You can't put that in a song. But it's interesting how I've started it.
Yes.
You know, all those kind of things are... I didn't even remember doing some of those things, you know. There's a song of mine called The Weakness in Me.
Yeah.
And the chorus is, why do you come here? And that's what I called it. Why do you come here? And it wasn't until literally after I'd recorded it that I changed it to The Weakness in Me.
Yeah.
It was, why do you come here up until then? Not quite the same thing, is it?
Extraordinary.
What do you think about, the legacy of the album now? You know, both of you.
Yeah, the album... Well, it's a very important album for me. It's the album that's given me this career. I mean, I know I made the album with Gus.
Mm-hmm.
That was great, fantastic, great experience. Worked with some fantastic musicians and people loved it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a massive hit. It was critically acclaimed and it was and that's important as well. It's really critically acclaimed. It was really well received. Everybody took to it and got to know me a little bit. And then we had the Back to the Night album, which was the second album. And that, as I say, I wasn't that happy about. And that album was like, oh, kind of, why did that happen like that?
Yeah.
And then you meet
Glyn,
and then it all gets back up to the level that it's supposed to be, and it's all really lovely. And I would say, even if the album hadn't turned out to be as successful and as, I was going to use the word life-changing, but I think that's probably the right word,
because it's
what's allowed me to be here.
Yeah.
Even if it hadn't, I'd still have a great fondness for it.
Amazing.
Because it was a really happy time. Glyn and I are still friends.
Here you are.
You know, I stayed friends.
Just
with... I stayed friends with Gus right up until his death. And I think that kind of respect and appreciation of each other's talents is what helps to make things really work.
Yeah.
And that's how I felt about Glyn. So this album is, for me, as I say, love and affection. Where no matter where I go, to Japan, whether I go to America, Canada, Belgium, Germany, doesn't matter where I go, love and affection is the song that's, that's Joan Armatrade, love and affection.
It keeps on going.
Yeah, it doesn't matter where I am. So it's really important, and it's important that I acknowledge it. It's important that I play it.
Yeah.
It's important that people know that I love it as much as they do.
Of course.
And the whole album has that same kind of connection for me.
Yeah.
You know, so it means a lot to me that album was made.
It all hangs together, doesn't it? It all really hangs together. It's all,
and it had that
similar
success.
Quality.
It was fantastic. Yeah.
That's great.
So that's teamwork.
Yeah.
Glyn?
Yeah. Without any question at all, this is one of the best records I was ever lucky enough to be part of. And I've made several million.
Seriously,
I hold it in the highest regard.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that.
For lots of reasons.
Yeah.
But perhaps as much as anything, it really did educate me to a completely new road of music that I'd never, nobody had before Joan started writing. I mean, I've been involved with a lot of rock and roll before that. And I mean, I was sensitive to all kinds of other music, not just rock and roll. But it was the most wonderful learning curve for me and also gave me a palette to work with to create sounds that hopefully suited the songs. I mean, the songs dictated the palette, basically.
But it's very well crafted, you know.
I'm very proud of it.
Sound-wise,
I mean, I'm
astounded.
Yeah. I'm very, very proud of it.
Of course,
I hold it in high regard, as I do the lady sitting opposite me.
And also, we should... I mean, we've mentioned the other musicians, but we have to mention them again, because all the musicians, without exception, who are playing on that record, on the next record, or the next record, they've all a part of making that be the success it is. Because you take one of those away, it becomes something different, you know? So we all of us have made it be this very successful thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's important that...
They all contributed tremendously.
Absolutely. Yeah. Everybody contributed. Yeah. And I always say, even the person who's made the tea, you know, that person coming in, it might sound silly, but that person who's coming in is having an effect.
Yeah, of course.
You know, everybody that's there at the time of making that record, or whatever it is you're doing, everybody who's in the room at the time has an effect on what's happening in the room. Whatever you want to say, even if it's, you think, actually... your effect is negative, get out. You know, but everybody plays their part, so you should give them.
It's so true. Let's hear the final song on the album. It's called Tall in the Saddle.
You were God's gift to girls, you persuaded, then you beat up on their hearts, you made it all. You're just a man. Dismount. You don't leave me downhearted. I am
That was the final track from the Joan Armatrading album, Tall in the Saddle. Last year you released How Does This Happen and What Does It Now Mean?
Yeah, so that one is just me.
Yeah.
just me playing. And you know, different people have the take on it. One of the best reviews I've had of the... Because, as I say, for the last however many albums, it's just been me. Uh-huh. And one of the best reviews I had was somebody said, the band was brilliant. That's me. So that was nice. and so that title is really saying the world is in a bit of a weird place. As we've all acknowledged, a lot of people have acknowledged that. And it was like, how on earth did we get to this stage?
Yeah.
And what are we going to do about it?
Yeah.
And hopefully we're exiting a little bit some of the weirdness and getting back to a bit of a better balance. You have to be able to have that debate, mm-hmm, and remain on good terms.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to criticize. You have to be able to say to somebody, that's not good, or that's, mm-hmm, bad, or that's rubbish. And I don't swear, but if you want to swear at somebody, you should be able to swear at them, mm-hmm, without
affecting a long,
yeah, without
a long friendship or,
yeah,
a long
without lesson. It being a violent thing, mm-hmm, you know. So that's what that was about. It's about, can we get back to a better balance where we talk about free speech? Free speech is being able to say, as I say, certain things without it seeming as if you're trying to kind of take over the world.
Wonderful stuff. Thanks both for being here.
My pleasure entirely.
An amazing record.
Thank you.
People will love hearing this.
I hope so.
I don't care.
Thank you to Joan Armatrading and Glyn Johns for taking me through Joan's self-titled third album. Every listening party, I like to recommend a few records that I've been listening to this past week. Well, as we were doing a Glyn Johns produced record, I wanted to suggest a few of my favourites. So let's go with Afterglow of Your Love by The Small Faces, taken from Ogden's Nut Gone Flake. I was 16 years old and I came to London looking for this record, which was rare. It was in a kind of like a circular sleeve. And I think I paid about 16 quid for it, which was a lot of money at the time, certainly when I was like 16 years old. But the record, it's been a staple in my life, you know, always, really. Great record. Also, Glyn produced Combat Rock by The Clash, and they'd done a double album, London Calling. Then they went for it even more with Sandinista, the triple album. And after that, I think the idea was to do another double album, and I think it was something about Fort Bragg, I think it was originally called. But anyway, they condensed it and brought it to a single album. You know, it was produced by Glyn, and it became Combat Rock. It's a great record. I've been going through some guttural punk records, and one of the first albums that I got was by a band who were one of the first three or four bands I ever saw live, a band called UK Subs. And this is a song, my favourite song from the album Crash Course. The song's it's a live track called Rockers. And I'm going to go with Gladys Knight and the Pips, Midnight Train to Georgia. It's a great story. It's like a great story song. Trying to find love in Los Angeles, and one of the characters in the song decides that they can't hack it and they have to go back to Georgia. Sad. But, you know, it happens. Replay any past episodes of my listening party by searching and following Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts. There you'll be able to catch up on every episode of the series, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Royal Blood, Elvis Costello and more. Every song in this episode of my listening party was taken from Joan Armatrading's self-titled third album. All tracks are written by Joan Armatrading. This album was released on A&M in July 1976. See you next time.
This is Absolute Radio.
Tim's Listening Party.